ultimately caused by, you guessed it, too much sugar. Obesity, insulin resistance, and beta cell dysfunction are all protective mechanisms. Obesity tries to prevent DNL from overwhelming the liver by safely storing the newly created fat in the adipocytes. We know this because patients with a rare genetic disorder called lipodystrophy, which is characterized by a lack of fat cells, show all the manifestations of metabolic syndrome: fatty liver, elevated triglycerides, and extremely high levels of insulin resistance without the weight gain. In rodent models of lipodystrophy, transplanting adipocytes back into these fat-free mice completely cures metabolic syndrome. Fat cells actually provide protection against metabolic syndrome rather than causing it. Why? Because without adipocytes, fat must be stored inside the organs where it causes metabolic syndrome. If fat can be stored inside adipocytes instead, no metabolic damage results. Obesity is the first line of defense against the root problem of hyperinsulinemia, insulin resistance. Similarly, insulin resistance is the body's attempt to prevent fat from amassing in the internal organs by preventing it from entering. The liver refuses to allow more glucose to enter because it is already overfilled, and the result is visible as insulin resistance, which represents a second protective mechanism. The final line of defense lies in shutting down pancreatic production of insulin. Blood glucose rapidly rises above the renal threshold and causes all the classic symptoms of diabetes. But this toxic load of glucose has been safely discharged out of the body and is unable to cause further metabolic damage. The core problems of too much glucose and insulin have been handled, but at the cost of symptomatic diabetes. The essential problem is too much sugar, and the body is desperately dumping it out in the urine. All the conditions we thought were problems, obesity, insulin resistance, and beta cell dysfunction, are actually the body's solutions to a single root cause, too much sugar. And when we understand the root cause, the answer to all of these problems and to type 2 diabetes becomes immediately obvious. We need to get rid of the sugar and lower insulin. If we fail to remove the problems of too much sugar, too much insulin, and ectopic fat, then the problem is chronic and progressive. When we treat the root cause, then type 2 diabetes, and indeed the entire metabolic syndrome, is a completely reversible disease. Bruno. Bruno, 75, had a 30-year history of type 2 diabetes, which caused him eye and nerve damage, as well as chronic kidney disease. He also suffered from gout, peripheral vascular disease, and high blood pressure. When we first met 4 years ago, he weighed 215 pounds and used 68 units of insulin daily. Once he began the IDM program, Bruno started on a low-carbohydrate, healthy-fat diet with 36-hour fasts every other day. Within 4 weeks, he was able to stop taking insulin completely and has not required any since. This result still astounds him because he had been using insulin for over 20 years. In addition, he no longer needs any medication for blood pressure or cholesterol. His latest A1C is only 6.1%, which classifies him as pre-diabetic rather than diabetic. Bruno adjusted quickly to his new diet and fasting regimen and finds it simple to follow, even several years later. He has maintained a 48-pound weight loss and a 24-centimeter reduction in waist size over these last 4 years. Ravi. Ravi, now 40, was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes when he was only 28 years old. After starting on blood glucose-lowering medications, he required higher and higher doses until he was finally prescribed insulin, which he was told he would need for life. In addition, he had developed high cholesterol and hypertension. He was taking 102 units of insulin daily, in addition to canagliflozin and metformin. Yet despite these huge doses of medication, his A1C was still 10.8%, which indicates that his blood glucose was completely out of control. When Ravi entered the IDM program, he switched to a low-carbohydrate, healthy-fat diet and started fasting 3 times a week for 36 hours each time. Within 2 weeks, he was able to stop taking any insulin, and his blood glucose numbers were better than ever. Within 2 months, when his cholesterol and blood pressure had returned to normal, he stopped taking metformin, and his doctor lowered his cholesterol and blood pressure medications to a quarter of their previous doses. In addition, he lost 23 pounds, and his waist circumference decreased by 18 centimeters. Now, 10 months into the program, he continues to take a single non-insulin medication, but his A1C is 7.4% and continues to improve. Part 4. How not to treat type 2 diabetes. Chapter 10. Insulin, not the answer for type 2 diabetes. The conventional treatment for both type 1 and type 2 diabetes has long been injection of exogenous, external, insulin. Human insulin, one of the great triumphs of modern pharmaceutical science, can be produced in a laboratory and packaged for convenient injection. For most of the early and mid-20th century, research focused on type 1 diabetes, which is caused by a severe lack of insulin. Without exogenous insulin replacement, cells cannot use glucose and they starve, leading to unrelenting weight loss and eventual death. This formerly fatal disease has become manageable, but injecting insulin comes with its own complications. It is essential to match the insulin dose with the amount of food being eaten, especially carbohydrates, since complications arise when blood glucose goes too far outside the normal range. Underdosing causes high blood glucose, hyperglycemia, and overdosing causes low blood glucose, hypoglycemia. Mild hypoglycemic reactions cause patients to sweat and shake, but more severe reactions can include seizures, loss of consciousness, and death. In 2014, nearly 100,000 emergency room visits and 30,000 admissions to hospital were directly related to hypoglycemia. Extremely high blood glucose can cause diabetic ketoacidosis in type 1 diabetes and non-ketotic hyperosmolar coma in type 2 diabetes, but these complications are relatively uncommon. On the other hand, until the early 1990s, it was unclear whether mildly elevated blood glucose was even all that dangerous. So, for many decades, the standard medical practice was to keep the blood glucose level slightly high, but below 10 millimoles per liter, the renal threshold for glucose. At this level, the kidneys completely reabsorb glucose so that none spills over into the urine, thereby avoiding the typical diabetic symptoms of excessive urination and thirst. And keeping the level slightly above normal avoids both hypoglycemia and the symptoms of high blood glucose. In the past, this was considered an acceptable trade-off, as nobody had yet found definitive proof that this level was harmful. This point of view changed irrevocably in 1993. Insulin and glucotoxicity. The Diabetes Control and Complications Trial, DCCT, a large randomized control trial of patients with type 1 diabetes carried out between 1983 and 1993, proved that intensive insulin therapy, including tight management of blood glucose levels, could have dramatic beneficial results. Close monitoring and multiple daily insulin injections to keep blood glucose levels as close to normal as possible could prevent the end organ damage associated with hyperglycemia. Diabetic eye disease decreased by 76%, kidney disease by 50%, and nerve damage by 60%. In 2005, researchers published their follow-up study called the Epidemiology of Diabetes Interventions and Complications, EDIC. They followed more than 90% of the original DCCT patients for up to 17 years, and found that the intensive insulin treatment had reduced cardiovascular disease by an astonishing 42%. These two studies clearly established the paradigm of glucotoxicity, that high blood glucose is toxic in type 1 diabetes. Some patients, however, paid a price. Hypoglycemic episodes during the DCCT study were 3 times more common in the intensive insulin group compared to those receiving standard treatment. Other patients experienced major weight gain. Over 9 years, almost 30% of the subjects in that group gained a significant amount of weight, defined as an increase in body mass index of more than 5. This far exceeded the impact on those receiving conventional insulin therapy. 1/4 of that intensive treatment group had increased their body mass index from 24, normal weight, to 31, obese. Given the health consequences of obesity, this was no small concern. Other disquieting danger signs appeared too. The weight gain was concentrated in the abdominal area, the central obesity known to be far more predictive of future cardiovascular disease. Other key risk factors, blood pressure and blood cholesterol, also increased. See figure 10.1 in the supplementary PDF. Over time, weight, waist circumference, and insulin dosage continued to grow inexorably. Intensive insulin treatment had led to metabolic syndrome. Type 1 diabetic patients with the most weight gain also developed the highest coronary artery calcification, CAC, and carotid intimal medial thickness, CIMT, scores. Their high insulin dosage reliably predicted these measures of advanced atherosclerosis. Heavy-handed dosing of insulin to reduce blood glucose had produced all the problems of excessive insulin, obesity, metabolic syndrome, and atherosclerosis. Despite these side effects, intensive insulin dosing was worth the risk for the proven cardiovascular benefits, but only for type 1 diabetes. However, this glucotoxicity paradigm, the idea that elevated blood glucose was the primary cause of end organ damage, was accepted for both type 1 and type 2 diabetes. The paradigm had not yet been proven for type 2 diabetes, but it seemed only a matter of time. The logical treatment was to give enough insulin or other medication to keep blood glucose normal. Even today, most doctors cling to this unproven treatment for type 2 diabetes like chewing gum clings to a boot sole. Does it work? Glucotoxicity and type 2 diabetes. The landmark DCCT trial had established the paradigm of glucotoxicity in type 1 diabetes. The United Kingdom Prospective Diabetes Study, UKPDS, started in the 1970s. Was expected to prove the benefits of intensive blood glucose control in type 2 diabetes. Researchers set out to determine two things about treatment. First, whether intensive glucose control could reduce complications. And second, whether there were differences among the different medications. The study randomly assigned almost 4,000 newly diagnosed type 2 diabetic patients to either conventional or intensive treatments, using the available medications of the time. Insulin, sulfonylureas, SUs, and metformin. Published in 1998, the UKPDS results were stunning. Stunningly bad, that is. Intensive treatment produced almost no measurable benefits. Sure, it successfully lowered the average blood glucose, but the higher dosages of medication resulted in more weight gain by an average of 2.9 kilograms, 6.4 pounds. In particular, those in the insulin group gained an average of 4 kilograms, 8.8 pounds. Hypoglycemic reactions significantly increased too, but these side effects were expected. Instead of mirroring the significant benefits of the DCCT trial, there was only some minor benefit in reducing eye disease. 10 years of tight blood glucose control produced no cardiovascular benefits. There were no fewer heart attacks or strokes. That discrepancy was shocking, but the story would get stranger still. Metformin was considered separately in UKPDS Substudy 34, which focused on overweight type 2 diabetic patients. Metformin lowered the hemoglobin A1c blood glucose level from 8.0% to 7.4%. This was good, but not as good as the results seen with the more powerful insulin and SU medications. Despite the mediocre blood glucose reductions, however, the cardiovascular results were spectacular. Metformin reduced diabetes-related death by a jaw-dropping 42% and the risk of heart attack by a whopping 39%, greatly outperforming the more powerful blood glucose-lowering agents. In other words, which specific type of diabetic medication you took made a huge difference. Metformin could save lives where the others could not, but its benefit had little or nothing to do with its blood glucose lowering effect. The glucotoxicity paradigm, proven in type 1 diabetes, failed miserably in type 2. The Cochrane Group, a well-respected independent group of physicians and researchers, later estimated that glucose control was only responsible for a minuscule 5-15% of the risk of cardiovascular disease. Yet that still wasn't the end of the story. Tired of all the controversy and still confident of the glucotoxicity paradigm in type 2 diabetes, the National Institutes for Health in the United States funded the massive Action to Control Cardiac Risk and Diabetes, ACCORD, randomized study, which began in 1999. The ACCORD study recruited more than 10,000 type 2 adult diabetics across North America who were considered at high risk for heart attack and stroke. The trial was designed, in part, to test whether taking medications for intensive blood glucose control would reduce the risk of heart attack, stroke, death from cardiovascular disease, and other cardiovascular events. One group of patients received standard treatment. The other group received high doses of medications and insulin to reduce blood glucose to as close to normal as possible. The first results from the ACCORD study were published in 2008 and proved that intensive medical therapy could reduce the A1C. Great. Did this make any difference to health? It sure did. Intensive treatment was killing people. Completely contrary to expectations, intensively treated patients were dying 22% faster than the standard treatment group, in spite of, or perhaps because of, the intervention. This equaled one extra death for every 95 patients treated. The study could not ethically be allowed to continue. Many similar studies finished around the same time. The results of the randomized Action in Diabetes and Vascular Disease Controlled Evaluation, ADVANCE, trial, which looked at intensive blood glucose control and vascular disease in patients with type 2 diabetes, were published simultaneously with the ACCORD results. Once again, this blood glucose reducing strategy failed to deliver cardiovascular benefits. Thankfully, it also failed to increase mortality. In contrast, blood pressure-lowering medications reduce cardiovascular disease as expected. So certain medications did truly benefit type 2 diabetic patients, but those that reduce blood glucose did not. Two further randomized controlled trials quickly followed to confirm these disappointing results. The Veterans Affairs Diabetes Trial, VADT, found that intensive medical therapy produced no significant benefits to heart, kidney, or eye disease. The outcome reduction with an initial glargine intervention, ORIGIN, trial, treated pre-diabetics with early initiation of insulin. There was no reduction in heart disease, stroke, eye disease, peripheral vascular disease, or any measurable health benefits. The classic medications for type 2 diabetes, including insulin, metformin, TZDs, and SUs, had utterly failed to improve health. The ACCORD, ADVANCE, and VADT trials all followed up with patients in the longer term and published extended results, but these yielded little new information. All the trials agreed that intensive glucose control with medications did not save lives and had marginal, if any, benefits. Furthermore, there were serious side effects, including an increased risk of hypoglycemic reactions. The most obvious concern was the well-known propensity of SUs, TZDs, and insulin to cause weight gain in patients who were already obese, which could lead to cardiovascular problems down the line. Metformin, which does not raise insulin, does not cause obesity, and this was the crucial difference. Peer-reviewed commentary from 1999 reveals that concerns were already percolating about the real issue, exacerbating hyperinsulinemia in a patient who already had too much insulin. Dr. Richard Donnelly, from the University of Nottingham, UK, wrote, The findings could be interpreted as indicating that insulin and sulfonylureas are equally harmful in the obese, possibly as a consequence of hyperinsulinemia. In type 1 diabetes, blood insulin is low, so replacing insulin is logical. In type 2, blood insulin is high, so giving more insulin seems problematic. After all, giving more alcohol to an alcoholic is not a winning strategy. Using heating blankets on a heat stroke victim is not a winning strategy. Treating sunburn by getting more sun is not a winning strategy. And giving more insulin to somebody with too much insulin is not a winning strategy. Logically, effectively treating type 2 diabetes requires an approach to lower both glucose and insulin, thereby minimizing both glucotoxicity and insulin toxicity. Insulin toxicity and double diabetes. Since intensive glucose control using insulin caused weight gain and metabolic syndrome, hallmarks of hyperinsulinemia, in both type 1 and type 2 diabetics, and since type 1 diabetics produce none of their own insulin, this hyperinsulinemia could only be iatrogenic, caused by the treatment. Sound familiar? Hyperinsulinemia leads to insulin resistance. In type 1 diabetics, too much insulin causes the exact same problems found in type 2 diabetes. In other words, heavy dosing of insulin in type 1 diabetes creates type 2 diabetes. These patients essentially develop so-called double diabetes. They produce none of their own insulin and yet have all the problems of hyperinsulinemia due to exogenous injection. Too much insulin causes insulin toxicity. Type 1 diabetics suffered all the same diseases as type 2 diabetics, but hyperglycemia was not the causal link. Hyperinsulinemia was the link. The European Diabetes Prospective Complications Study, EuroDiab study, looked for factors that predicted risk of death for type 1 diabetics. It found that glucotoxicity, as measured by hemoglobin A1c, was not a significant risk factor. Instead, the most important modifiable risk factors were waist-to-hip ratio, a measure of visceral fat, blood pressure, and cholesterol, all markers of metabolic syndrome and hyperinsulinemia. Many other studies confirm the EuroDiab results. For example, the Golden Years cohort study followed 400 patients with type 1 diabetes who lived for over 50 years with their disease. They had beaten the odds and survived. What was their secret? Well, it certainly was not tight blood glucose control. Their average A1C was 7.6%, with some as high as 8.5 to 9%, which is well above the standard recommended target of 7.0%. In fact, not a single Golden Years cohort patient had an A1C in the normal range, ruling out glucotoxicity as a major player. The entire Golden Years cohort of survivors had suboptimal blood glucose control, and yet their health was excellent. The common factor was a low insulin dosage. Obesity, high blood pressure, and other manifestations of hyperinsulinemia were notably absent. There are two toxicities at work here. Early on in type 1 diabetes, glucotoxicity is the main concern. In type 1 diabetics, this is caused by the body's inability to produce enough insulin. In type 2 diabetics, it's the effect of insulin resistance. But in either type 1 or type 2, if you continually raise the dosage of insulin to lower blood glucose, you simply trade higher insulin toxicity for less glucotoxicity. And over time, insulin toxicity becomes the key determinant for survival because it leads to metabolic syndrome and its sequelae, cardiovascular disease and cancer. The optimal treatment strategy reduces both blood glucose and insulin simultaneously. Type 2 diabetesville, a parable. Remember the Japanese subway pushers from Chapter 6? How they were shoving more and more people into subway cars already bursting with passengers? and how ridiculous a solution that seems to dealing with the problem? That's exactly what happens when we use insulin to treat type 2 diabetes. When I tell my patients with type 2 diabetes what's happening in their bodies, I use a slightly different analogy. Instead of cells in your body or passengers on a subway car, imagine you live on Liver Street in a town called Diabetesville. Everybody is friendly and leaves their door open and unlocked. 3 times a day, Mr. Insulin drives down the streets and delivers a small cup of glucose to each house for residents to enjoy. Life is going well and everybody is happy. Gradually, over time, Mr. Insulin comes around more and more often, and soon he's dropping off whole heaping buckets of glucose. He needs to empty his glucose truck every night, or he'll lose his job. For a while, you store the excess glucose in your house, and life goes on. But finally, your house is completely filled with glucose, which is starting to rot and stink. You try to reason with Mr. Insulin, but to no avail. Every house on every street has the same problem. Now what do you do? Exasperated, you shout, "I don't want this toxic glucose. I've got too much already, and I don't want any more." You lock the front door so Mr. Insulin can't shove any more toxic stuff into your house. A little glucose was fine, but this amount is getting ridiculous. The dose makes the poison. You're simply protecting your house by resisting Mr. Insulin's toxic glucose load. That's insulin resistance. Mr. Insulin now finds it harder and harder to get rid of his glucose load and is worried he's going to get fired. So he asks his brothers to help. They break down your door and shovel in barrels of glucose until you increase your front door's resistance with steel bars. It's a race between Mr. Insulin finding more insulin henchmen and you increasing resistance. More insulin leads to more resistance, and more resistance leads to more insulin. With so much glucose stored inside the house, you turn it into fat, package it, and send it out to your friends on Pancreas Avenue, Skeletal Muscle Drive, and elsewhere. In our cells at this point, the glucose has stimulated insulin and flooded the liver, which has activated DNL to transform this glucose into new molecules of fat. The excess fat is accumulating in the liver, causing damage, so the engorged liver decompresses itself by moving this fat out to the pancreas, skeletal muscle, and around the abdominal organs. Meanwhile, insulin is still trying to force glucose inside, and the liver cells protect themselves by increasing insulin resistance. Back in Diabetesville, all the doors have been triple barred and guarded by dogs. Big dogs. The insulin brothers are now unable to deliver their huge glucose burden. Glucose is spilling over into the streets. Unsure what else to do, the specialist, Dr. Endocrine, steps in. He decides that the glucose is indeed toxic, and the streets must be cleared immediately. Despite the hordes of insulin clansmen prowling around, Dr. Endo decides that the best solution is to use even more insulin. He hires more insulin thugs to shove more glucose into the reluctant houses, clearing off the streets. He gives himself a pat on the back. "Look," he says, "the streets are nice and clean." But eventually the houses fill up again and increase their resistance yet again. Even the extra insulin cronies cannot shove any more glucose in. Does Dr. Endo get rid of some of the glucose? Does he stop glucose from coming into the city? No. He has only learned one solution to every problem. Give more insulin. To a man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. In our bodies, excessive sugar has led to too much insulin. Yet the currently accepted solution is to prescribe even more insulin. If insulin levels were already high, why would you want to give more? Instead of eliminating the sugar, insulin merely moves it around the body into all the organs. Higher insulin doses only create more insulin resistance. Even while the symptom of high blood glucose improves, the disease of type 2 diabetes worsens. We accept that high blood glucose levels are harmful. But here's a question seldom asked. If this high glucose level were toxic in the blood, why wouldn't it also be toxic inside the cells? As glucose enters the cells faster than it can be used for energy, it accumulates inside the cell. The reason insulin resistance develops in all the organs and in all peoples of the world is precisely to shield against this toxic sugar load. It's a good thing, not a bad one. Insulin doesn't actually eliminate glucose from the body. It merely shoves the excess glucose out of the blood and forces it into the cells. Somewhere, anywhere. Eyes, kidneys, nerves, heart. Over time, all the organs simply start rotting from too much glucose. Using medications like insulin to hide the blood glucose in the tissues of the body is ultimately destructive. The key to the proper treatment of type 2 diabetes is to get rid of the excess sugar, not just move it around the body. The problem is both too much glucose and too much insulin. Hyperinsulinemia, insulin toxicity, and disease. Hyperinsulinemia was considered a potential problem as far back as 1924. But only more recently have researchers started to look closely at the data, and the evidence is everywhere. Too much insulin leads to insulin toxicity, which is strongly associated with many diseases. Atherosclerosis and cardiovascular disease. While type 2 diabetes is associated with numerous complications, including nerve, kidney, and eye damage, the morbidity and mortality associated with cardiovascular diseases is the most important. Simply put, most diabetic patients die of cardiovascular disease. As early as 1949, animal studies demonstrated that insulin treatment causes early atherosclerosis, also called hardening of the arteries, which is a precursor to heart attacks, strokes, and peripheral vascular disease. Insulin facilitates every single step along the inflammatory pathway that marks the progression of the disease, including initiation, inflammation, foam cell, fat-laden cell, formation, fibrous plaque formation, and advanced lesions. Moreover, fibrous plaque contains insulin receptors, and insulin stimulates the growth of plaque, which accelerates the atherosclerosis and substantially raises the risk of cardiovascular disease. Experimentally, these same studies showed that preventing the excess insulin could reverse the condition. If you are not on diabetes medications, the risk of heart disease increases with the degree of hyperglycemia. Insulin lowers blood glucose, so it has always been assumed it would protect against disease. But that is only true if glucotoxicity causes the heart disease, which it does not. What has not generally been appreciated is that, if you are not on diabetes medications, the degree of hyperglycemia reflects the severity of diabetes. Trading insulin toxicity for glucotoxicity is not obviously beneficial. The UK General Practice Database identified more than 84,000 newly diagnosed diabetics between 2000 and 2010. Treatment with insulin did not lower heart disease risk. Rather, it more than doubled the risk of death. The same held true for heart attacks, strokes, cancer, and kidney disease. Insulin could reduce blood glucose, but not heart disease or death. Patients with an A1C blood glucose level of 6.0%, which was considered excellent control, fared just as poorly as those patients with an A1C of 10.5%, which is considered uncontrolled diabetes. Ultimately, heavy-handed use of insulin could reduce glucotoxicity, but only at the expense of insulin toxicity. As in type 1 diabetes, high insulin doses were not good. They were bad. See figure 10.2 in the supplementary PDF. These results were not new. Reviews of large population databases, such as the 1996 Quebec Cardiovascular Study, established hyperinsulinemia as a prime risk factor for heart disease. In Saskatchewan, Canada, a review of more than 12,000 newly diagnosed diabetic patients found a significant and graded association between mortality risk and insulin exposure level. It wasn't a trivial effect either. The high insulin group had a 279% higher risk of death compared to those that did not use insulin. Treating type 2 diabetes with insulin was not good. It was bad. Simply put, the higher the insulin dose, the higher the risk of dying. Moreover, the longer the treatment time with insulin, the greater the risk of cardiovascular disease. A 2011 study showed that both low and high blood glucose carried excess risk of death, again reflecting the dual toxicities of glucose and insulin. Once again, insulin use was associated with a mind-boggling 265% increased risk of death. A Cardiff University review of almost 10% of the UK population from 2004 to 2015 found that lower A1C was associated with elevated mortality risk, driven mainly by a 53% increased risk with the use of insulin. In this study, no other medication increased the risk of death. A Dutch database associated high daily insulin doses with three times the cardiovascular risk. In heart failure patients, insulin use is associated with more than four times the risk of death. Excessive insulin is toxic, particularly in a setting of type 2 diabetes, where baseline insulin is already very high. Giving more insulin will lower the blood glucose, but worsen the underlying hyperinsulinemia. Trading insulin toxicity for glucotoxicity is not beneficial. Cancer. Diabetes, as well as obesity and prediabetes, increases the risk of many different types of cancer, including breast, colon, endometrial, kidney, and bladder cancers. This suggests that factors other than increased blood glucose play a major role in the development of cancers, further disproving the glucotoxicity paradigm as the major cause of disease. Insulin, a hormone well known to promote growth, can drive tumor growth, and women with the highest insulin levels carry a 2.4-fold higher risk of breast cancer. Obesity may be a contributing factor, but hyperinsulinemia is associated with an increased risk of cancer independent of weight. Lean and overweight women, when matched for insulin levels, exhibit the same risk of breast cancer. The intimate link between insulin and cancer is reinforced by the discovery of a single mutation in the P10 oncogene that significantly increases the risk of cancer. What's the connection? This mutation increases the insulin effect. It lowers the blood glucose and reduces the risk of diabetes, but increases the risk of obesity and cancer. Similarly, medications that raise insulin toxicity are associated with higher rates of cancer. Insulin use increases the risk of colon cancer by approximately 20% per year of therapy. The UK General Practice Database revealed that insulin increased the risk of cancer by 42% compared with a glucose-lowering drug that did not raise insulin. And a review of the newly diagnosed diabetics in the Saskatchewan population disclosed that use of insulin raised the risk of cancer by 90%. It's simple to understand why high insulin levels should favor cancer cell growth. First, insulin is a known hormonal growth factor. Second, cancer cells are highly metabolically active and need large supplies of glucose to proliferate. Insulin increases the risk of cancer, and once cancer has been established, high blood glucose enables it to grow faster. Chapter 11. Oral hypoglycemics, not the answer. As of 2012, more than 50% of the American population has diabetes or prediabetes. This stunning statistic means more people in the United States have prediabetes or diabetes than not. It's the new normal. It's also made selling insulin and insulin-like drugs the money-making opportunity of a lifetime, which may explain why it continues to be prescribed for pre-diabetics and type 2 diabetics when it doesn't make sense. In 2008, a joint statement released by the American College of Endocrinology and the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists encouraged physicians to consider drug treatment of pre-diabetic patients, despite the fact that no drug had yet been approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. In 2010, the definition of type 2 diabetes was broadened, ostensibly to help with early diagnosis and treatment. It is perhaps no coincidence that 9 of the 14 outside experts on the panel that made this recommendation worked in various capacities with the giant pharmaceutical companies that made diabetes medications and stood directly in the path of an unending torrent of money. In the lead-up to this decision, individual members received millions of dollars, and the American Diabetes Association itself reaped more than $7 million in 2004 alone from its pharmaceutical partners. When Dr. Banting discovered insulin in 1921, he licensed the drug to pharmaceutical companies without a patent because he fervently believed this life-saving miracle should be made available to everybody who needed it. Yet insulin, now available in many different formulations, is estimated to have cost the U.S. healthcare system $6 billion in 2012, driven in part by steep price increases. Between 2010 and 2015, these newer insulins increased in price from 168% to 325%. In 2013, Lantus, a long-acting form of insulin, earned $7.6 billion, making it the world's best-selling diabetes drug. Various other insulins took another 6 of the top 10 spots on that list. Between 2004 and 2013, no less than 30 new diabetes drugs came to market. Despite several setbacks, by 2015, sales of diabetes drugs had reached $23 billion, which is more than the combined revenue of the National Football League, Major League Baseball, and the National Basketball Association. See Figure 11.1 in the supplementary PDF. The focus of treatment of type 2 diabetes has always been to lower blood glucose because it is associated with better health outcomes. Every 1% increase in the hemoglobin A1C is associated with an 18% increase in risk of cardiovascular events, 12 to 14% increase in the risk of death, and 37% increase in risk of eye disease or kidney disease. But correlation is not causation. Lowering blood glucose with medications, as opposed to diet and lifestyle, is not necessarily beneficial. Consider two type 2 diabetic patients with an identical A1C of 6.5%. One takes no medications, and the other uses 200 units of insulin daily. These might seem like identical situations, but they're not. The first situation reflects mild diabetes, while the other reflects severe diabetes. The use of insulin does not change severe type 2 diabetes into mild type 2 diabetes. The cardiovascular risks are completely different. Indeed, insulin may not have any benefits at all. No evidence exists that these newer insulins are any more effective than the original. Indeed, health outcomes for type 2 diabetes have only worsened even as these newer insulins have become more widely prescribed. And exogenous insulin injections are no longer just for type 1 diabetes. Almost one-third of diabetics in the United States currently use some form of insulin. This statistic is slightly horrifying, considering that 90 to 95% of diabetes in the United States is type 2, for which the benefits of insulin are highly questionable. In fact, other medications are available for type 2 diabetes. Several classes of drugs are or have been available through the years and are still being prescribed to a bigger and bigger group of patients. Despite their popularity among doctors, these blood glucose-lowering pills, oral hypoglycemics in medical speak, are not long-term solutions to diabetes either. I divide these medications into three categories based upon their effect on insulin and thus body weight. In general, the more they raise insulin levels, the more they cause weight gain and many of the complications associated with diabetes. Medications that cause weight gain. Sulfonylureas, SUs. Sulfonylureas stimulate the pancreas to produce more insulin, thereby effectively reducing blood sugars. The sulfonylurea, SU, drug class was discovered in 1942 and has been widely prescribed since then. By 1984, more powerful second-generation SUs had been introduced in the United States. The most commonly used drugs in this class include glyburide, glipizide, and glycoside. In its research on type 2 diabetes, the United Kingdom Prospective Diabetes Study, UKPDS, see Chapter 10, demonstrated that intensive treatment with the SU class of drugs produced almost no benefits in controlling the long-term complications of diabetes. Of particular concern was that exacerbating weight gain in already obese patients could lead to cardiovascular problems down the line. Extended follow-up of the original UKPDS study showed only mild cardiovascular benefits. The death rate was reduced by 13%. The paradigm of glucotoxicity was established for type 2 diabetes, but only barely. Blood glucose-lowering medications had marginal benefits that took 20 years to become apparent. The risk associated with increasing insulin, with its accompanying weight gain, could barely offset the benefit of lowering glucose. Further studies have borne out these concerns. A 2012 review of more than 250,000 newly diagnosed type 2 diabetics in the Veterans Affairs database across the United States showed that starting treatment with SUs instead of metformin carries a 21% higher risk of cardiovascular disease. Studies from the UK and elsewhere estimate the use of SUs increases the risk of heart attack or death by 40 to 60%. Furthermore, these risks increase in a dose-dependent manner. That is, the higher the dose of SU, the greater the cardiovascular risk. A 2012 randomized controlled trial, the gold standard of evidence-based medicine, confirmed that initial therapy with SUs compared to metformin increases the risk of vascular disease by 40%, despite equal blood glucose control. The importance of this study cannot be underestimated. Two drugs that control blood glucose equally could have widely divergent effects on cardiovascular health. The main difference? One stimulates insulin and causes weight gain, whereas the other does not. Glucotoxicity is equal, so the difference is the insulin toxicity of SUs. Thiazolidinediones, TZDs. During the 1980s and 1990s, drug companies did not develop a single new oral hypoglycemic agent because the number of patients using them was too small and the benefit was dubious. But the growing number of diabetics and pre-diabetics changed the economics of diabetic medications completely. In 1999, the Federal Drug Administration, FDA, approved the first new diabetes drug class in more than a decade, the TZDs. These drugs bind to receptors in the fat cells, making them more sensitive to insulin and thereby amplifying insulin's effects. So TZDs, such as rosiglitazone, sold under the brand name Avandia, and pioglitazone, sold as Actos, lower blood glucose but do not raise insulin levels. Instead, they help the body use the available insulin more effectively. Predictably, research showed TZD's magnifying effect was both positive and negative. Blood glucose was lowered, but patients could reliably expect to gain 3 to 4 kilograms, 6.6 to 8.8 pounds, of fat, as insulin is a key driver of weight gain. They also retain fluid, typically around the ankles, but sometimes in the lungs, which cause shortness of breath and congestive heart failure. These setbacks were mild, but worse was still to come. By 2007, the influential New England Journal of Medicine reported that rosiglitazone unexpectedly increased the risk of heart attacks. The FDA hastily convened an advisory board of independent experts that same year. Similar deliberations took place in Europe. The FDA investigated concerns of data tampering in the Residential Environment and Coronary Heart Disease, RECORD, study, one of the largest trials that had proved the safety of rosiglitazone, and eventually concluded that the concerns about heart disease were well placed. Rosiglitazone was associated with a 25% higher risk of heart attack. By 2011, Europe, the UK, India, New Zealand, and South Africa had all banned the use of rosiglitazone, though the FDA continued to allow its sale in the United States with a warning label for patients. These concerns devastated sales. Doctors stopped prescribing the medication, patients refused to take it. And by 2012, sales had fallen to a paltry $9.5 million. The debacle left some beneficial policy changes in its wake. All diabetes medications henceforth were required to conduct large-scale safety trials to safeguard the public interest. Dr. Clifford Rosen, the chairperson of that FDA committee, clearly identified the key problem. New drugs were approved based solely on their ability to lower blood glucose, under the unproven assumption that this effect would reduce the cardiovascular burden. However, the evidence to date, including the UK PDS, ACCORD, ADVANCE, VADT, and ORIGIN studies, had failed to confirm these theorized benefits. Lowering blood glucose had little to do with protecting against the organ damage of type 2 diabetes. A second TZD, pioglitazone, faced its own concerns about bladder cancer. Compared to other diabetes medications, the use of pioglitazone is associated with a 63% increased risk of bladder cancer. The risk rises with longer duration of use and higher dosages. The known side effects of weight gain and fluid retention were enough to give physicians pause, but these new concerns about cardiovascular and cancer risks effectively sealed the fate of the TZD drug class. In North America, they are very rarely prescribed, and usage has effectively ceased. Medications that are weight neutral. Metformin. Metformin, the most powerful of the biguanide class of medications, was discovered shortly after insulin and described in the scientific literature in 1922. By 1929, its sugar-lowering effect was noted in animal studies, but it was not until 1957 that it was first used in humans for the treatment of diabetes. Biguanides work by blocking gluconeogenesis and thereby preventing the liver from producing glucose. This effect lowers the risk of hypoglycemia and weight gain because it does not increase insulin levels in the body. Metformin entered the British National Formulary in 1958 and was introduced in Canada in 1972. The FDA did not approve it in the United States until 1994 due to concerns about an extremely rare side effect called lactic acidosis. However, given the powerful life-saving effect demonstrated in the UK PDS compared to other comparable diabetes drugs, the benefits are felt to be well worth the risk, and it has become the most widely prescribed diabetes drug in the world. Since metformin does not raise insulin, it does not cause obesity, and therefore does not worsen diabetes. So metformin sounds pretty good. The problem is that metformin, and other biguanides, does not take away the root cause of the illness. That is, they do not rid the body of excess sugar. Remember, hyperinsulinemia causes type 2 diabetes. While these drugs target blood glucose, they do little to relieve the underlying hyperinsulinemia. They take care of the symptom, but since they do not eliminate the cause, insulin resistance continues to rise, and diabetes is managed but not eliminated. Clinically, this is obvious. Once started on metformin, it is highly unlikely that one will ever be able to stop it without intensive lifestyle changes. Therefore, metformin may manage the disease for a while, but eventually, the patient will require higher and higher doses. The underlying disease process continues progressing. Solemn as a clergyman. Dipeptidyl peptidase 4, DPP4, inhibitors. In 2006, the FDA approved a new class of medications called the dipeptidyl peptidase 4, DPP4, inhibitors. These drugs are designed to lower blood glucose by blocking the breakdown of incretins, which are hormones released in the stomach that increase insulin secretion in response to food. High incretin levels stimulate insulin release. However, this insulin response is not sustained, and therefore these drugs do not cause weight gain. The risk of hypoglycemia is also low. Hopes were high for this new class of medication, but a study completed in 2013 called the SAVOR study, Saxagliptin Assessment of Vascular Outcomes Recorded in Patients with Diabetes Mellitus, along with 2015's Trial Evaluating Cardiovascular Outcomes with Sitagliptin, TECOS, study, soon dashed these hopes. The FDA mandated both randomized controlled trials after the rosiglitazone debacle, and neither found safety concerns with the long-term use of these medications. However, neither were there any protective effects against cardiovascular diseases. These medications effectively lowered blood glucose, but did not reduce heart attacks or strokes. Once again, the glucotoxicity paradigm was proven false. Yes, you could reduce blood glucose, but no, you were not any healthier for it. In spite of that, the fact that these medications were at least not killing people was apparently a good enough reason to prescribe them. In 2015, the top DPP-4 inhibitor, sitagliptin, raked in $3.86 billion, enough to rank it as the second best-selling diabetes drug in the world, trailing only Lantus, a long-acting form of insulin. Medications that cause weight loss. Sodium glucose cotransporter 2, SGLT2, inhibitors. The newest class of medications, called SGLT2 inhibitors, block glucose reabsorption in the kidney, allowing glucose to escape in the urine, which replicates the protective mechanism used by the body during severe hyperglycemia. What happens if you don't block this protective mechanism, but enhance it? Where the classic diabetes drugs increase insulin, the SGLT2 inhibitors lower it by forcing the excretion of glucose outside the body. The result is lower blood glucose, but also lower body weight, blood pressure, and markers of arterial stiffness. As the root cause of diabetes is hyperinsulinemia, here at long last was a drug that effectively lowered insulin. Would this finally translate into proven cardiovascular benefits? It wasn't just a home run, it was a grand slam. A 2015 study called the EMPA-REG study, empagliflozin, cardiovascular outcomes and mortality in patients with type 2 diabetes mellitus, revealed that SGLT2s reduced the risk of death by an incredible 38%. The good news did not stop there. It reduced the risk of progression of kidney disease by almost 40% and the need for dialysis by a stunning 55%. The elusive cardiovascular and renal benefits that virtually every previous study had failed to deliver were finally found. Tellingly, the blood glucose lowering effect was very modest. The A1C only dropped by 0.47%, far less than almost every other medication currently in use, but the benefits were far greater. This result once again underscored that glucotoxicity is a minor league player. The SGLT2 inhibitors simultaneously lowered both insulin toxicity and glucotoxicity, and the results were nothing short of amazing. Weight loss is one of the most noticeable side benefits of this class of medication. Not only did patients lose weight, unlike virtually every other dietary trial, they kept the weight off even after the 2 years. Canagliflozin, for example,